started looking at all your emails.
Okay, we're going to get started. Dr. Yao is going to talk about some advancements in the treatment of lung cancer.
Okay, so sorry, the short notice, and I threw most of these slides are from talks I give to med students. And you guys are all, what, grad students, first, second year, third year?
First year,
okay. And I know Dr. Yinda Murray came and talked to you about, I looked through the slides, looked like you went through epidemiology, lung cancer, some of the surgical treatments. And he went over lung cancer screening, I think, as well, right? So I'm a medical oncologist here. I started in August, and I'm a MD PhD. I did my MD PhD here in Buffalo, and then went out to San Diego for residency and fellowship and the postdoc, and now back here. And it was a long winter compared to San Diego. but exciting to be back here. So I spend about a third of, I spend 30% of my time in the clinic, which means about a clinic and a half a day, and I spend the rest of the time in, I'm also in cancer genetics program here, so I have a small lab as well that I spend time in. And my research interest is in KRAS mutant tumors, mostly lung and pancreatic tumors, and interested in tumorigenesis. I was told that this class is to give you guys some exposure to clinical, what we do in the clinic. So I'm going to focus mostly on clinical stuff. And so I see as an oncologist, mostly lung cancers that that are in advanced stage. So lung cancer, still even with screening. So, you know, I think Cy told you about the screening. If you look at the data, lung cancer screening for high-risk patients, which are smokers, around the age of 50, that annual low-dose CT screening is probably more effective at detecting earlier lung cancers and improving your lifespan than mammography, colonoscopy, any other screening modality. And yet, as of last year, the take rate of lung cancer screening is about 6% of the eligible people that could be screened in the U.S. So, you know, we're not doing as well as mammography and colonoscopy in getting screening out there. So we do have something that could save lives with screening, but it's not taken up. So still, most of the lung cancers will present as either metastatic, that's the big orange pie, or as locally advanced, meaning spread to some lymph nodes. And I think he showed you this slide before, but basically you do worse the more extensive your stage is. So for when we see patients in the clinic, we don't like to do too much pathology, but we still need to split up lung cancer. Lung cancer, of course, is a heterogeneous disease. Lots of different theoretical cells of origin leading to different histologies, and so the biggest distinction we usually make is small cell lung cancer and everything else. I think he talked to you a little bit about the epidemiology of small cell lung cancer, but they're neuroendocrine cells, and they make up a minority of lung cancer, about 15%, almost 98-99% of small cell lung cancer patients have a history of smoking. You almost never get it if you're a non-smoker. And so with the declining smoking rates, it is coming down a little bit, but it's also the cancer that we really haven't made much headway in terms of therapy. And then on the other side, you have non-small cell lung cancers, and us in the clinic, most of the distinction is between squamous cell and adenocarcinoma. Everything else is relatively rare. Most lung cancers are non-small cell lung cancers, 85%. And most of those are adenocarcinomas, 40% of that 85%. So mostly we see adenocarcinomas. But of course, in smokers, we see squamous cells and small cell lung cancers. And then there are these intermediate things, these lung cancers that start from neuroendocrine cells but are less aggressive than small cells, so like carcinoid. And then there's this in between, this LC-NEC, large cell neuroendocrine carcinoma. So we know from lots of sequencing efforts, this is all from the TCGA, sequencing lots of these tumors, we know that these different, so not only do they look different under the microscope and stain differently and represent different cells, but they also have different mutations. So in small cell lung cancer and squamous cell non-small cell lung cancers, we find mostly loss of tumor suppressors. We don't see a lot of activating oncogenes. So in small cell lung cancer, almost every tumor has P53 loss and RB1 loss, and then a smattering of other mutations. For squamous cells, also P53, and a lot of other tumor suppressors. And adenocarcinoma looks different. Still, P53 is common, but here we start to pick up oncogenes like KRAS and EGFR and ALK rearrangements. And we also know that they all don't respond the same to immune therapy either. You know, this is the famous picture now, but all tumors arise in different ways and from different etiologies, and they have different mutation rates that seem to correlate with their response to immune therapy. So, you know, we have melanoma and UV skin damage giving the rise to the highest tumor mutation burdens, and then we have squamous, and then followed by adenocarcinoma. But adenocarcinoma has a big range. Those at the bottom are the oncogene-driven EGFR non-smoking patients. That biology tends to be young, in their 40s and 50s, females, non-smokers, most heavily represented in East Asian populations. So in China, a huge percentage of people are present with EGFR mutations, and they generally have low mutation rates, so they're kind of at the bottom of this mutation burden plot and don't respond very well to immune therapy. So, you know, when I see patients in the clinic, basically we have diagnosed systemic medications, and basically they come in three flavors, and right now mostly it's chemotherapy, which has been around for ages. We have newer chemos, but all targeting, dividing cells at the different checkpoints. They're targeted therapies. So having identified some oncogenic mutations, we try and turn off the signaling that some of these tumor cells are dependent on. And so we have lots of pills and antibodies targeting these different tyrosine kinases that are activated in cancer. And then most recently, we have these immune therapies. And in lung cancer right now, it's mostly the checkpoint inhibitors. So cancer cells, in order to grow, of course, need to evade the immune system. And one of the ways they can do that is PD-1, which I'm sure you've all heard of, and it basically turns off T cells. And you've probably all seen this curve before as well. So the red one is, just ignore the red line, it's the hypothetical curve. But you guys have seen Kaplan-Meier. You can't get a medical oncologist to talk to you without Kaplan-Meier. So I have a couple Kaplan-Meier curves in here, but basically we're looking at a percent of people that are alive versus time, and with traditional chemotherapy, we get some response at the top, a big drop-off, and eventually everybody dies. With the targeted therapies, targeting these tyrosine kinase inhibitors, we can move the curve over, so more people respond for a longer time, but still, eventually, the cancer does learn to be resistant and die. And then with immune therapies, with the immune system acting as the surveillance, we're all excited about is that little tail in the curve where there are some people who respond for a long time, but it's still the minority of patients that get this benefit. So we'll talk a little bit about treatment options in 2017 for some of these histologies. So I'll start with small cell. Hasn't changed very much in the last 30 years. So small cell lung cancer is a very aggressive, quick cancer. This is the type of cancer that you get all these weird syndromes. You get, because it grows really fast, and a lot of times if you have a central tumor and it grows really quickly, then you'll block your venous return in the SVC, and so you get this facial swelling, arm swelling, and it can be sort of emergent if we let it go on, because small cell lung cancer grows so quickly, it can cut off the circulation and you can pass out and lose consciousness. And so, but because radiation and chemo are so effective, we can usually shrink these tumors pretty quickly. We can also put stents now. You know, get a variety of other paraneoplastic syndromes. But because they grow so fast, they are very sensitive to chemotherapy and radiation. Almost everybody responds to chemotherapy in the beginning. The only problem is that even when we get complete responses on CAT scan, so we don't see any tumors left on the CAT scans. Invariably, these tumors come back, and when they come back, they are no longer sensitive to chemo. So here's the horrible Kaplan-Meier's that have not changed much in extensive stage small cell lung cancer. So small cell lung cancer in the clinic, we stage a little bit differently. We stage based on, there's just two categories, limited versus extensive. So instead of stage 1, 2, 3, 4, you have limited stage where the lung cancer is confined to one side of the lung and can fit in a radiation field. And in that case, we give chemotherapy plus radiation together. For, we say curative intents, but only about 20 to 30% make it out 5 years without getting cancer back. So only about 20 to 30% cure rate, even when it's confined just to one side of the lung and we can radiate it. Extensive stage is anything else, anything that we can't fit in one radiation field, so basically cancer that's spread. And with our frontline combination chemotherapy, on average, people live about a little under a year. So very, very aggressive. Almost half of patients are dead by that year. Adding more chemo, this is a trial where we tried to add more and more chemo. We couldn't change the curve at all. And then when the cancer comes back, it's really hard to treat. So with second-line chemotherapy, we start counting in terms of weeks. So half of people are dead by 6 months. And really, the response rates, when we say response rate, we usually mean tumor shrinking or at least not growing on that first scan, and with the second line chemotherapy, it's about a 15 to 20% response rate if we're being optimistic. So we need new things, and so like everything else in oncology, we throw immunotherapy at every cancer and see. And presumably, small cell lung cancer is caused by smoking. Should have a higher mutation burden, but so far all the trials have failed. It looks like checkpoint inhibitor alone is not enough. There is some promising data from the combination of inhibiting PD-1, inhibiting the off switch, and also inhibiting CTLA-4, the exhaustion switch, that maybe there is some response. And Dr. Yanamuri had this paper on his slides, but the idea is that if you look at patients treated with these checkpoint inhibitors, those that have a high mutation burden seem to do better. And based on the latest data from the clinical trial combining the CTLA-4 inhibitor ipilimumab with PD-1 inhibitor nivolumab, if you look at the high tumor mutation burden cohort, it's still low numbers, but overall response rate of 50% compared to 20%. And a one-year survival of 60% compared to like 5 to 10% is promising. So in the clinic, if I have a young person who has relapsed, I am looking at mutation burden to see if we want to give. We have the option to give this combination immune therapy, just because there's so few options. And so I just wanted to. You can. There's a nice paper last year. I know you guys are all PhDs, so in thinking about, you want to find, you know, something that we have difficulty treating in the clinic. And so this is a paper where they looked at this problem of relapse in small cell lung cancer with a mouse model, and they took PDXs. Basically, they took patients' biopsies of tumors and then they implanted them into nude mice. And the ones that took, they gave chemo, and they found some that were resistant to chemo. And they sequenced all of them. They showed that the pretreatment and the resistant and the chemo resistant, that there are no change in their mutations. So these are all the paired samples, and all the blocks kind of go in pairs. So the acquired resistance wasn't due to mutations, which was what we would hypothesize, and these tend to take longer, and the chemo resistance comes out very quickly. And so when they looked at their sequencing data, they found that in their resistant PDXs on the top right, that this SLOFN11 gene was downregulated, and they worked out the mechanism that it was through methylation, and that through EZH2 mediated methylation of silencing the SLOFN11. led to these tumors in these animal models being resistant to chemo, and if they inhibited EZH2 with the drug, then you can get some of these tumors to become sensitive to chemo again. So a nice paper for you to review. So moving on to the other side, from small cell lung cancer to non-small cell lung cancer. So again, we have a frontline combination chemotherapy in metastatic non-small cell lung cancer, and this is kind of the benchmark. So we give a combination of two chemos with platinum, and we know that adding more chemos has not changed this curve at all. So compared to doing nothing versus chemo in the solid line, you know, it's not great, but on average people live about a year on chemo, and there is definite benefit. So a lot of people come in, they say, I've got stage 4 lung cancer, and you know, why do chemo? And it both extends life and also tends to, if you compare not giving chemo to chemo, the side effects from the lung cancer progressing are still usually worse than the side effects from chemo, and our chemo is getting better, and our supportive care is getting better. So chemo actually for stage 4 lung cancer is pretty tolerable now. And so we make this distinction in non-small cell between squamous cell and everything else. So in the clinic, all I care about is squamous versus non-squamous, based on this trial where the chemo you choose has different outcomes depending on the pathology. So in squamous cell carcinoma, the yellow chemo seems to do better, and in the non-squamous, the blue chemo did better. And so based on your histology, we decide on the chemos. And these are both newer combinations, and the pemetrexed in particular is a very tolerable regimen, very easy to give, and with superior outcomes, and again, median overall survival on the right about 12 months. We combine that with maintenance chemo now, and we know that maintenance can push this out to about 14 months. Okay, so back in 2008, this is where we were. These were the trials we were doing in 2008, when VEGF pathway was discovered, and that tumors were using it to make new blood vessels, and thought that antibodies against the VEGF receptor might be beneficial, and so we combined the anti-VEGF antibody to chemo. And this is these were big trials. There were 800 patients, 400 in each arm, and you know, we made the change from 10 months on average overall survival to gaining about 2 or 3 months with a very expensive drug. This hazard ratio is what we look at when we think about clinical utility and kind of our arbitrary line that the FDA used to approve drugs was 0.8. So we needed. It just means they needed 800 patients just to get to that really, really, really not very great hazard ratio just to get approved. And so this was back in 2008, and still everybody was dying. So then we entered into this targeted therapy era, and with all the sequencing data we got, we found that especially in adenocarcinomas on the top there, that we can identify driver mutations in a significant subset of those with adenocarcinoma. And the biggest slice of the pie on the top right being KRAS in the red. We have a big pie of 33% with no identifiable driver mutations. But the next biggest slice of the pie is this 23% in blue of this EGFR mutation. And so we had anti-EGFR pills available. When we tried to give it to everybody with stage 4 lung cancer, this trial was a little bit scary, and the companion one with a gefitinib, where actually if you gave the pill in patients, people did worse than with chemo, and they also showed this with gefitinib alone compared to chemo, that if you looked in unselected patients, these pills could actually be worse than chemo. So it wasn't until then in all these trials, sorry, I didn't have time to link all the papers, but there's a lot of nice science history back here. If if you look at these trials, and this was only 2012, relatively quickly, we looked at everybody on the trials, and they identified that there seemed to be patients that were responding really well to the pills, and they identified these exon 19 deletions and this exon 20 missense mutation, that this subset of mutations seemed to do much better. And so then they designed a trial where we only gave the pill to those that had those activating mutations, and then we get stuff that works and works very well. So a huge separation in the curve, a very prolonged progression-free survival with chemotherapy, on average, you go 6 months before the cancer comes back. With the pill, we were getting out to 10 months. But still, people were relapsing. And so another really good, there's a bunch of cancer discovery papers that are really interesting. Basically, we took all the patients that were relapsing, we sequenced their biopsies again, and we identified this that they were escaping through this T790M mutation. So we're making another mutation on EGFR to escape the action of the drugs. And so AstraZeneca then developed an inhibitor that can inhibit this inhibit EGFR even with this T790M mutation. And so we got a new second and third generation EGFR inhibitors. And we showed then eventually that we were sequencing people when they relapsed, and if they had the T790M mutation, then we gave them this third generation drug, Tagrisso or osimertinib, and people would respond again for a long time. And now, last year, instead of starting with the first line, we just start with this the third line, osimertinib, and compared to just our regular first line TKI, and now we're getting out to, on average, people being cancer free at diagnosis for up to 2 years just on the pill before tumor learns to grow past this pill. Still, people will become resistant, but this pill is pretty amazing. It was also designed to only target the mutant EGFR, so you have almost no side effects on it. And with disseminated lung cancer, you can go 2 years on average. Some people are going 3-4 years on the pill. So, in a relatively short amount of time of 5 years, we made some substantial progress. And again, compared to 2008, where we're using 400 patients in each arm to get a hazard ratio of 0.8, now we have 200 patients in each arm, and the hazard ratio is under 0.5, which is really what we expect now. Anything that has less than this, we're not as excited about in the clinic anymore. Same story with ALK rearrangements, so much less common, also seems to tend to happen in younger female non-smokers. Only about 3-6% of lung adenos have ALK ROS1 rearrangement, and here we have a pill that we can use. First generation was crizotinib, compared to chemo, was much better, and now we have second and third generation ALK inhibitors that bind more tightly, and the latest one is alectinib, and again, we're also seeing similar effects, about 2 years on average of patients not needing anything but these pills. And now we're in the immune therapy age, and so for those that get their lung cancer and have smoked, we tend not to find these mutations. Those mutations only occur in the minority of patients in North America. Only less than 20-25% of patients can get a targeted therapy, and so we had a big slice of the population that couldn't get anything but chemo. And then we started with these checkpoint inhibitors, and this is the long-term data from the first from the phase one first in human nivolumab trial in lung cancer. So heavily pretreated patients, and what we saw was at 5 years, there's still 16% of people are alive at 5 years. These are people that progressed on like 3 lines of chemo and just got nivolumab. So there's a subset of patients. It's still very small, 16%, but 16-20% of patients will respond, and they seem to respond for a long time. Compared to the, previously, the chances of you being alive in 5 years with metastatic lung cancer was almost nothing, under 5%. So with this, everybody raced in, and so since the first in-human trial started in 08, we have four checkpoint inhibitors approved for use now in non-small cell lung cancer, and it's been a very quick progression. These were all the trials that showed that these immune therapies were better than chemo in the second line. So after you had frontline chemo, you live longer, and they all have the same little tail compared to chemo. And so we have three different PD-1 inhibitors we can use. Then we looked for now the race is to figure out how to move this 20% up to 100%. Right, and so one of the things that we started to look for was expression of PD-L1, which is what we're inhibiting. Theoretically, if you express a lot of PD-L1, then you might be predicted to respond well, and it did correlate. So if you stain highly for PD-L1, you had a higher chance of response. You have on average about a 50% chance to respond if you stain very highly on the right, compared to about a 20%, less than a 20% chance if you're negative for PD-L1. But this is where the science and the clinic struggle a bit. So, we let the drug companies pick their antibodies that they're going to use on the trials. And with the FDA, you have to pair the trial and the drug with the antibody and how you score these things. And so each company has a different antibody. Each company had a different cutoff. The trials were run with different cutoffs. And so it turned what was, relatively straightforward into kind of a more difficult conundrum. So it's not a perfect biomarker, but it's what we have right now. And it does work to some extent, and we can move now in those patients that had high PD-L1 who have we expect about a 50 to 60% response rate. They do better with doing immunotherapy first compared to chemotherapy. And you can see the overall survival of 12 months are really, really pretty impressive, with over 70% being alive at a year. And despite people having crossover, meaning they get chemo, that when they progress, they can still get the immune therapy. So even though people are still getting immune therapy, it seems like it did better up front. And just end with what they presented at AACR just a couple weeks ago. Going all the way from where we were back in back with just chemo to now, trying to improve this tail of the curve, and so we tried. They tried to add chemotherapy to the checkpoint inhibitor. So I think the immune therapy area is kind of where the clinical translational medicine is a little bit faster than the basic science, because the basic science models, these animal models, are all more difficult, needing an intact immune system. It's a little harder to study, and so it's been much faster to just throw these drugs and get data back. So there are some arguments as to whether chemotherapy would, in addition to the immune therapy, would improve the response or inhibit it, because theoretically chemo will lead to cells dying and releasing antigens and maybe inflaming things and making the immune system more active. On the other hand, chemotherapy is also known to affect the immune microenvironment, and it can increase immune suppressive cells like Tregs and those kind of cells. And so, there's some debates, but it did look like when we tried the chemotherapy combination with the PD-1 inhibitors, that it did look like in some patients it worked really well, and this was just released. This is the result. So they had a cohort of about 60 patients that looked like very promising. Almost 75% of those patients responded to the combination. And so they started a big phase 3 trial that just reported out. And so this was just published a couple weeks ago, and the curves now are out to here. So compared, if you remember the 2008 curve, it was a very quick decline. Now with the combination of chemo with immune therapy, so with chemo alone, with our better chemo alone now, we can get out to a median overall survival is about a year. So on average, patients were living about a year. The median overall survival hasn't been reached yet for the combination yet. We're anticipating it'll come out somewhere around a little under 2 years, but we'll have to wait for that data. But again, really good hazard ratios, and so this is our for patients that qualify, that met the eligibility criteria for this combination. It's what we give now. I can say a lot more, but that's kind of what I have. So when I see a metastatic lung cancer patient in the clinic now, first we need to know the histology, and then once we know it's an advanced lung cancer, the pathology department automatically looks for PD-L1, so we know whether they're higher, medium, or higher, lower negative. And then in people that don't have a lot of symptoms yet, and we don't need to start any therapy immediately, then we send their tumor for sequencing. And that nowadays in the clinic only takes 2 weeks for it to come back. And if they have a mutation, we give the pill. If they don't have the mutation, we give either immune therapy if they're eligible, or chemotherapy with immune therapy. There's still some patients that we have to do chemotherapy with, and then they get immune therapy later. But lung cancer is still serious disease, still hard to treat, but we're making progress, always trying to get more people to do lung cancer research. If you have any questions, feel free to email me. I don't know if this is helpful at all, but any questions? You guys all want to enjoy the nice day outside?
Can you then email me a copy of your slides and I can post them on the
What's the email? Chapter for what?
Emma
Honey, the film.
What do you call it?
Checking your phone in Rosso.
Maybe they did it with Dr. D.
Oh.
No, I think it's. Aren't you the one who's writing the book?
No. That's okay.
Why are you in me?
Are we going to see the
Dinner?
MAGA, like
you're going to
the
word.
Yeah. I'm going to draw.
Okay.
I don't like iced tea though. I'm not a